Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
The one thing that Chase really got right with Sopranos in general is the duality of their lives, that they have the same problems you do. Their kid's not doing well in high school and this is going on. And then when they walk out the door, though, they flip a switch. They don't, like, just because their kids are in middle school, they don't care if the dope they're dealing is getting dealt in the middle school. They just don't want their kid to do it. And the girls are trafficking are the same age as their daughters. Wow. And it's a duality of that, that they literally can flip the switch. Now,
hey, gang, welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you, folks, so much for coming back every week. If you're not aware, we do have a Patreon channel here. It's patreon.com/Game of Crimes, where you can come over and listen to more goofy stuff. But actually, we have some really good stuff over there, too. So come over and check us out. You can even join that for free, and you get to hear the first 5 minutes of each session that we do every month. So come over, and if you like it, then you can sign up for one of the levels. But just like I do every week, I got another fantastic guest here for you. You're not going to be able to see his face. He has some contractual obligations. I think maybe the Taliban's still looking for him, but he won't admit to that. We'll see if we can get him to admit to it. But it's a pleasure to introduce to you Rob D'Amico. Rob, welcome to the show, buddy.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, and just to give you a little quick background, this man has almost 29 years with the United States Marine Corps. And also 26 years as an FBI special agent, and not just your typical run-of-the-mill special agent. I'm just baiting you right now. I'm not going to tell you about all that because he was involved in some what I think is pretty cool stuff. You'll probably think he's crazy because most people think we are crazy just for going into law enforcement. But this is going to be a good one. This is going to be a cliffhanger. And I hit Rob up here just a couple hours ago about our small-town police blotter. Just like all our guests, he doesn't hesitate. Just, Rob, we have a little disclaimer we'll go through real quick. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we take the show very seriously, but we never want to miss an opportunity to have a good laugh at some of the stupid things that people do out there in their criminal life. And it's just proof that they picked the wrong career choice. They should have selected something else. So you folks know I'm here in Orlando. Rob's in Florida also. So he's got the first story up from Florida. So Rob, all yours, buddy.
Yeah. So it's funny because I'll get on Instagram and I'll start looking at the body cam videos of people dealing with cops, sometimes on both sides. But the ones that really are funny are the ones that try to tell the cops the laws and how to do things or
yeah.
Are intoxicated. So this one is about a guy named Pancake. And that's actually his name. So battered his elderly father, leaving the victim with severe bruising and welling face and eyes. And the investigators say Eric Thomas Pancake, 38, pummeled his 72-year-old parent during a family dispute in the Palm City home that he lived in with his dad and his mom, still living at home at 38. But he apparently resides with his parents and struck his father. When police arrived, the residence, the victim had severe bruises, swelling, face and eyes consistent with multiple strikes. So the cops reported he appeared intoxicated and belligerent. Well, that was no joke on that one, but
yeah.
And then he pleads the fifth because, you know, these guys know the law. They're good lawyers. They just don't happen to have a law degree. And then in response to law enforcement questions, I plead the fifth. And then he proceeds just to turn around and place his hands behind his back. So I don't know if that in fact is I'm not going to tell you, but I'm just going to, you know, show you that I am under arrest. And so he ended up going out and I think posting a bail $5,000 in the county jail. But again, the people that represent themselves, it's not going to go too well. And then I remember in the academy, though, they told us in the beginning, everyone thinks criminals are so smart. But can I tell a real quick one?
Sure, absolutely.
FBI responds to bank robberies, especially back in the day. So two agents go in, bank robber gives them the note. And, you know, they take the note, put it in a Ziploc bag. They're going to look for, you know, fingerprints and stuff. But they look on it and it's a deposit slip. So on the back of the deposit slip, they write, this is a holdup. Give me, you know, I have a gun. Give me all your money. So they, there's a name and, you know, bank account. So they figure that the person whose bank account was probably in front of them on the desk as they were writing stuff out and he left his deposit slip. So they, after they do all their interviews at the bank, they go over to the house, the deposit slip, and they knock on the door. Guy opens a door and they see past him on the little kitchenette table, a bag with all the money. and they realize that this guy wrote the note on his own deposit slip. So they go, you're under arrest. And he goes, God, you guys are good. I don't know how you did it.
Rocket scientists.
Yeah. That was a lesson. Like, hey, they might not be the smartest in the world.
Oh, they never are. You know, that story that you talked about, I mean, just the fact that he's beaten up his father and also at his age, what's he doing still living home with mom and dad?
That's indicative of the whole situation there.
Oh, yeah.
It's just up the road. Palm City's just up the road. So yep. I know it well.
Yeah, just south of Vero there.
Yeah.
And I bet you if you took a real close look at Pancake's forehead, there's probably an imprint of an L up there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Thank you, man. I appreciate you reading that. We're going to run over to Clearwater, which is, I don't know what it is, Rob. You've probably lived in Florida longer than we have, but most of the stupid crime stories in Florida seem to come out of Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater area. Such a beautiful place.
Well, that's most of the dumb crime stories come out of Florida, you know, to the states, the rest of the states.
Oh, yeah. Never a shortage. What I like to say on here is you can choose to be a leader. You could choose to be a follower. We choose to be a leader in the stupid criminal category here in Florida. Go team. All right. So you guys, you're going to love this little story here. After a planned sexual threesome failed to materialize, a Florida woman, not a Florida man this time, she became angry and she pummeled her boyfriend in the face. An alleged attack witnessed by the woman who had been invited to the couple's residence for some group sex. Mm-hmm. We're going to start X-rating this show. According to investigators, Angel Lynn Curl, who's 47 years old, and her boyfriend invited a female friend to their Clearwater apartment Saturday evening to engage in sexual activity. And by the way, these stories are here. These are very current stories. These just happened in the last couple of weeks, both of them. But the plan was interrupted when all parties declined participating in sexual activity. The arrest affidavit does not reveal why the tryst was aborted. Following the sex declination, Curl allegedly became angry and repeatedly struck the 47-year-old victim in the face as he was seated on the couple's living room couch. Per the cops, the female invitee, she watched Curl strike the victim in the face with a closed fist multiple times. After being read her rights, Curl denied hitting the man. Of course she did. Those bruises and things just popped up there. Anyway, Curl was arrested about 1:15 a.m. this past Sunday for domestic battery, a misdemeanor, and she was released from custody later that day on her own recognizance, which I have real problems with that because she beat somebody up. If I beat somebody up, I bet I have to post a bond. Anyway, the judge says she can't have any more contact with that victim, and I don't think he's going to be upset by that. But man. She had plans on her mind, and she was ticked off that those plans didn't come to fruition.
And him, what he thought was going to happen to then getting beat up.
Oh, my gosh. Well, maybe it's going to be violent sex. Who knows? I don't know. Anyway. All right. Let's get into our show here today with Rob. And just quickly, I want to give a shout-out to Patrick O'Donnell. You guys hear me talk about him all the time. He hosts the podcast Cops and Writers. He's a retired sergeant from Milwaukee PD. And if you go back to episode 77 here on Game of Crimes back in November of 2022, because we're in our fifth year here now, you can hear his entire interview. But Patrick and I have gotten to be very close friends whenever he comes to Florida. We'll get together, he and I and a couple other former cops, one from Chicago, one from New York City, and go have lunch together. And I'm trying to convince him to move on down here. I don't know, something about his wife. She didn't want him to. But Patrick told me, and we're always swapping ideas for who could be guests. And he told me about two. One was Jerry Williams, who you heard just recently on here. She's a retired FBI agent. And then he said this guy, Rob D'Amico, has an unbelievable story, some of the things he was involved with. So was fortunate enough to get them both on here. And Rob, the way we start out these interviews is just tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what your family dynamics were, what your mom and dad did. Do you have brothers and sisters? Did you play sports in school? That kind of thing, please.
Yeah. So grew up in New Jersey, Northern Jersey, because there's a difference between Southern Jersey. Southern Jersey, we just call Philadelphia, but Northern Jersey is God's country. So grew up there. Parents, my mom was a teacher, art designer, and then teacher. And then my dad was an accountant, then ended up being chief financial officer of a company. Two older sisters, one went in accounting, one was in art. So kind of family split between creative and numbers. I majored in accounting at Ohio State. Actually, I enlisted in the Marine Corps in high school. I wanted to go directly in the Marine Corps, enlisted. My parents wanted me to go to college. So the compromise was I enlisted in the reserves while I go to college. So after boot camp, the day after I graduated high school, I went to boot camp. Thank God, because it gave me some discipline.
Yeah.
It gave me, I need it because I was a punk New Jersey kid. And, but I went to Ohio State, majored in accounting because I, even though I wanted to be a Marine, I knew I also kind of, my mom had found something way later. I was already in the FBI. What do you want in second grade? What do you want to be? And I wrote FBI agent and Marine. And I'm not sure where FBI agent came from. I knew I saw Marine movies, but
wow.
So I majored in accounting because I was good at numbers. My dad had always taken me to work and explain accounting stuff. And I wasn't good at English. So I'm like, we'll stick with accounting. Got off, graduated college, went on active duty in Marine Corps as a lieutenant. That was right before the first Gulf War. Went over to that, came back. I again thought I was going to go over to Marine Recon and stay 20 years. Marine Corps had other plans. They were going to, because of the drawdown after the Gulf War, you had to augment to get in your regular commission. I hadn't taken an ROTC scholarship in order to stay in the reserves. So I ended up having to get off active duty. I went back into the reserves, down to Third Force Recon, and did about 2 years of just schools, like, you know, amphib recon school, jump school, all that stuff. And then, because the Bureau was in a hiring freeze. And then I think in 1994, we had been working with the FBI office in Mobile when I was in the Marines, helping them learn how to climb buildings and do all kinds of stuff. And the guy came out that we dealt with and said, hey, the FBI is about to open up hiring. You be an accounting major, Marine officer, you need to apply. That was in November, and I was at the FBI Academy by February. It was the fastest, like, because they hadn't hired in 3 years, I already had a clearance. I went through a small field office in Mobile. It was like you put the application in, and a few months later, I was actually at the FBI Academy. First office was down in Miami, worked fugitives. Violent crime fugitives on with a bunch of cops, which was fun. Not a lot of paperwork, just got to chase people and arrest them. And I ended up doing 2 years undercover against the guy they end up writing Sopranos about. He was up in New York, but his father-in-law was down here in Florida. I ran a nightclub, lived on a yacht. It was, you know, like for being a year in the Bureau, because normally you have to have 5, 6, 7 years in the Bureau before you can do undercover. I just had the I had the background that they wanted, interviewed with Joe Bistone. And they said, if he says you can do it, you can do it. And interviewed with him, which was unbelievable. Found out he lived right up by me in New Jersey when he was doing his 6 years against the crime family up there. End up getting out of that, making the FBI's hostage rescue team, which is a full-time tactical team. So went up to Quantico.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Before we get in that, let me go back and ask a couple questions here.
Okay.
And when you were in high school, did you play any sports?
Oh, I did. High school, I was on the ski team and tennis team. My dad was a big tennis player. I was a pretty good tennis player. I wanted to play football. I played football a little bit when I was younger. I played baseball, but not in the high school. So high school, the sports I was doing was tennis and skiing.
How did you pick the Ohio State University?
So my mom actually grew up in Ohio. She went there, and then my older sister went there. My second sister went there. So I don't even think I applied anywhere else. And they also had, I wanted like in the reserves, you get the military occupational specialty of the reserve unit you're going to. And they had an infantry unit there and I wanted to be infantry. So it all kind of married up and worked out.
And that's major what you just said there. Here's a man going through college and I can't hardly balance a checkbook. So accounting, I tried accounting and it just, it didn't like me. I didn't like it either. But as he's going through college at Ohio State University, he's serving his country in the reserves of the United States Marine Corps. I mean, I was a cop going through college, so I was working nights and going to college in the daytime. But that's just real admirable that you had the maturity and the discipline at that young of an age to know that you wanted to serve your country.
Yeah, it came very, I used to play Marine. Everyone like, oh, you're playing Army. I'm like, no, I'm playing Marine. You know, like I said, I saw something early that made me choose that. So, but I've always wanted to do it. So to me, it was no brainer. It wasn't even the decision. Like I said, talking my parents into enlisting or the compromise we came up. But I always knew I wanted to do it. So to me, it was just a given.
Yep. Did your buddies in college that knowing that you wanted to go to the FBI and that you were in the Marines, they think you were crazy or what'd they think?
No, I hung out mostly with a lot of my Marine buddies, a lot of guys in the reserves that were there. And I also was a bouncer at a bar. So the two crazies were pretty nuts. We had at Ohio State, we had back in the day, we served beer in buckets, and I'm not talking about bottles of beer. Like you draft beer in a bucket, 27 beers at happy hour. It sold for $5.
Wow.
We had one of the largest bars. It's called Mother Fletcher's. You went down the stairs. And we had at nights 20 to 25 bouncers. I was like 205. I was the smallest guy. Wow. Most of them were just 250-pound jack dudes.
Yeah.
And we got in fights like a lot. We got in fights with entire rugby teams, fraternities. It was game on. I remember one night I was like in 9 different fights in one night.
Whoa.
It was pretty crazy. And it was good though, because a lot of the cops on High Street were also Marine reservists. They were senior in rank and they kind of kept me out of trouble, so to speak. They'd come in and say, and back then short hair wasn't in. So I had a Marine haircut and they're like, hey, they're looking for the short hair bouncer. And I'd kind of run out the back. Can't get away with that nowadays, but back in the day it was pretty crazy.
Oh, that's great. Did you ever break any bones in any of those fights?
So I can't say what I did to other people.
Bones.
I did. So I worked at a second bar off campus, and that was a nice one. We wore like tuxedo shirts and black pants. I think it was like a Wednesday or Thursday night. It was a slow night, so we didn't have that many people on. And there was a bachelor party. Bachelor party was in there. And they were getting rude and stuff like that. And I went over and said, hey, look, guys, you got to calm down or you're going to get asked to leave and stuff. And they were calm for a little bit. But on the way out, they decided to go at me. And it ended up being like, I think, 7, 8, 9 guys. And they broke my nose and was it seven or eight places?
Wow.
And it didn't even bruise. It was like one of those things was just crooked. I ended up, I ended up going home. I had to go home the next day. It was a like spring break or something. And my mom had to pick me up at the airport and drive me to the ear, nose and throat guy to set my nose. And I didn't realize it was one of the dumbest things I've ever did. I drove over cause I had all my friends I was going to meet and stuff. And he started talking about anesthesia. And I'm like, I got to drive. Like, and he's just like, you just want me to set it? I'm like, yeah. I didn't realize he was going to do it when he did it. Cause he kind of gets up there and he's feeling around and he sets it and all but one place set. So he's now got his back on the wall and his nurse is holding him as he's pushing the one part of my nose that finally pops. It hurt so bad. I'm like, don't ever let me do that.
Eyes are watering here. Just listen to you talk about it.
And then what's funny though, is still a little crooked. And then I was in as a Marine lieutenant, I was on active duty and we're doing the pugil sticks and a pugil stick came through like the face mask wasn't big enough and it hit my nose. And I'm like, I broke my nose. And they're like, it doesn't look broke. I went to the Navy you know, clinic there. I'm like, hey, my nose is broken. They're like, it looks fine. I'm like, check it. So they x-rayed it, and actually it set it the back way, and it was straight back. So
the Marine Corps is there for you.
Yeah.
Never expected that. Wow. So you get in the FBI, and you go to Quantico. Your academy was it, what, about 13 weeks back then?
I think it's about that.
So we all have – I went through the DEA Academy at the FBI Academy. So we all have academy stories. You got any funny ones, maybe things you had to write memos for?
So when I get there, like – I got in and they just started opening up hiring. So we're sitting in his first day of class, like 50 people in the class, and they start at the back and introduce yourself, what you majored in and what you did, why you joined the FBI. And I'm kind of in the front, and the guy next to me, Dan, former Green Beret. So we're sitting there, and like one of the first guys was a Harvard law grad, was a assistant district attorney, blah, blah, blah. And then there was truly a rocket scientist. He worked for Pratt Whitney. There was a guy that had 5 masters, and I'm looking at Dan. I'm like, are we the bullet sponges? Or like, are we supposed to like go in the building and get the bullet to save these guys? Cause it was kind of like daunting. It was like, wow. And they had all these elegant reasons to join the FBI. And I said, why do you want to be the FBI? I'm like, because it's effing FBI. I didn't have an answer. But then it's funny because we went out like we got a break, and me and Dan at the time both dipped tobacco coming out of the military. So we put this dip in, and the staff counselor comes over, very prim and proper FBI guy in his suit and stuff. And he goes, what do you boys have in your, and I'm thinking he's asking what kind of dip I got. I'm like, well, I got Kodiak. I got Copenhagen. He's got Kodiak. And he goes, is that chewing tobacco? And we're kind of like, yeah. And he goes, oh, we don't do that here. And I'm like, we don't? So we couldn't do it in the building. So we had to go between breaks and go outside to have a dip. And I'm like, I'm not sure this is all for me. And then it's also funny, the DEA Academy was much more militaristic. And I don't, in a bad way, you wore fatigues, you jogged, and you chanted like in the Marine Corps, like you chanted as you ran. Right. That wasn't FBI. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I joined the wrong one. Like literally, like at that point, just because it was the fit type of thing. But it ended up good. But the funny part though is at the end of the day, academically, I actually was competing with the Harvard law grad. I actually beat him on the law test, and it came down to the last test, and it was an organized crime test, and I got nothing wrong, 100%. And I now was going to be the top academic guy. I had gotten the top shooter award. And the top academic guy at the time gave the speech to the graduating class and the director and stuff like that. I don't think the staff counselor didn't like me dipping really wanted me talking. I cursed, like, you know, not that I would do it there, but I cursed a lot. And, you know, I was kind of rough around the edges. I think he wanted to. Well, the Harvard law guy, he gotten like 2 or 3 wrong on the organized crime test, and he made this pitch that how those 3 questions weren't covered by the instructor or whatever. And sure enough, the staff guy gave him credit, so he beat me out by like 0.1%, and he got to give the speech, and I'm like, I got you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like you're somewhat of an overachiever to start with there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's everything in the world is competitive to me. Like it doesn't like, and I have to be early at everything. We're actually, when I was doing running the FBI's counter drone unit, they started doing the federal executions again. And they thought there was going to be a bunch of protests. So they had us go out to make sure people weren't flying drones over. And the 3 guys that they executed and were sitting there like on the road as they're driving them down in the van. And at one point, like, the execution time was at something and they were like running late. And I'm like thinking, if that was me, I'd be like, hey guys, we're going to be late. Like, this is my execution, but I'm not going to be late to it. Like, you know, we got to be 5 minutes early for that.
Everybody's got standards.
Yeah. So, yeah. So everything's competitive to me and I can't stand to be late. And late is anything less than 10 minutes early.
Good for you. Are you married?
Yeah.
Your wife puts up with that?
We're separated, but not because of that. It's one of those, But I do remember my dad sitting in the car and all us three kids in there and him yelling at my mom because she was late. So it's just
ingrained.
Genetic.
Yeah, there you go.
Plus the Marines helps.
Wow. All right. So when you filled out your wish list in the academy, where did you want to go?
I think I put originally was like North Carolina, kind of Southeast, because I was living in North Carolina at the time. And then I put Southeast, so I ended up getting Miami. Which wasn't bad. A great place to work. You can't swing a dead cat without hitting a criminal in Miami.
Right. Right.
Like everyone, it's not just, you know, the drugs, it's public corruption. It's this, everyone down here just about is involved in some type of criminal activity.
It's a target rich environment.
Yeah. So working here was fun.
Did you live in Miami or did you live in Broward?
So I've originally was living in Aventura. It's like 4 miles from where I live now, actually. So it was in Dade County, but just over the line. It was in Aventura. I lived across from where Apache boats, where they make the go fast boats, like the ones with trip 500s. And it's been seized like a number of times. And actually, the DEA and Customs, when I got out of my apartment one day coming home from work, I see two guys who are obviously feds. And I said, hey, who are you guys with? And they're kind of like backed off and I show them my creds. And it turns out they're surveilling Apache boats. And my apartment looked directly into it. And like, oh, they gave us this apartment over here. I said, look, mine literally looks into their offices. I got cable TV. I got a full fridge. So you can go sit in a, you know, empty apartment or you can. So for like 2 weeks, they were using my apartment to do the surveillance.
Oh, that's a good job.
Yeah.
Wow. And a bathroom that works.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Not peeing in a bottle. So in your fugitive, any really big fugitives that we might have heard of that you guys captured down there?
It's so long ago. I'm sure like there was some, like Saturday nights were always crazy because you get, if you had anyone on America's Most Wanted, all the calls come in. And as much as like most of them, 99.9% of them are not the lead.
Right.
That 0.1% are. So you got to like literally fulfill them with some of the stuff. But I remember one guy, like he killed his girlfriend, stuffed her in a suitcase. And we end up, me and the guy Clay were doing surveillance on a place that we thought it might be him. And sure enough, turns out, and we're just, it's Saturday afternoon and we're kind of waiting. And all of a sudden we see him, it's him. And he's coming out like going. And so we're like, screw it. We're just going to do the rest. Other guys are on the way, but we don't have time. So as we pull up, I'm driving. Clay jumps out of his car and he didn't realize that he didn't have his gun belt on. So he's jumping out of the car without a gun. And I literally throw my pistol out the window, out his door to him. And he like catches my gun and puts it on the guy.
Oh,
and
then, there you go.
And the guy kind of resisted and Clay gave him the common perennial nerve kick, like where you basically kick him with your shin bone across the thigh and it hits that nerve bundle. And he dropped like a sack of potatoes and then it was in Plantation. So it's funny because Plantation cop comes up and we're going to book him through there. So we put him in the Plantation PD car and our other guys are all arriving. They're like thinking they're about to do the rest. We're like, oh, he's already in the car. And the Plantation cop comes out and he's like, hey, thanks guys. We're like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, he shat himself and you put him in my car. Cause when he kicked him that hard, the dude lost all control. And the poor cops now got him, you know, in the car. And
nasty. Yeah.
But what's funny is that cop ended up becoming an FBI agent and coming to the hostage rescue team. Keith is his name. And we did multiple deployments, not together, but over to Iraq and Afghanistan. Great guy. He's up in West Palm Beach now, but never he never let us forget that we put him in a guy in his car. That,
but did he ever get you back?
No, not really. yeah. I'm not going to say not yet because long-term memory, he could do something now, but.
That's what friends
I think
are
maybe because it was Clay that kicked him. He didn't get me back.
That's hilarious. When you mentioned working undercover and you met Joe Pistone, so did you go to the FBI's undercover school?
So I what ended up happening, I'm with the violent crime squad and the fugitive squad, and we taught street survival. So we teach regular squads, you know, just kind of tactical things and all. So it's like a 2-day school. Squad comes out. We teach them all kinds of car stuff, you know, apartment stuff, just to tune them up and, you know, let them see the latest and stuff. Because a lot of, you know, agents don't, you know, you go through the academy and then, you know, so we're doing street survival with them. And the squad breaks for lunch and it's an organized crime squad. And the supervisor starts asking me about my background as a Marine. Before the Bureau, I actually did some executive protection bodyguard work for a guy who owned a yacht type of thing while I was waiting to get on with the Bureau and stuff and going through the stories. And he had a role where he had a cooperating witness, someone who got jammed up laundering money, who was connected to the mob. And they were putting a case together where they were going to have this cooperating witness introduce this older undercover from the West Coast, a legend in the FBI undercover world, did undercover against the Weatherman underground for like 7 years straight.
Wow. I mean,
some stuff that really crazy. But he was a legend and he wasn't going to move here. He's just going to come in for a week or two, a month. And the cooperating witness was going to be his business partner and they were going to launder money and deal heroin with the mob. And they had an idea. They had this yacht that was seized that we were going to use as an office. And then so they wanted someone, an agent around to keep an eye on the cooperating witness to be able to facilitate the undercover knowing who he was and take care of the yacht and end up with the nightclub. So he asked me, it's supposed to be a bit role where I wasn't really involved with the bad guys as much. I took care of the boat and drove the undercover around. I always carried the dope or the money type of thing. And he said, do you ever think about doing undercover? I'm like, absolutely. It's something I've always wanted to do, but I also knew it took 5-7 years. He said, well, this is a smaller role. Let me check. So he went back to, you know, to the bosses and they said, look, if we're going to have, because Pistone was back in the Bureau at the time and he was working at our stagehand that helps undercover ops. So he wasn't in office. They're like, hey, drive this location, use your personal car. Don't use a BU car. Don't wear anything looks like the Bureau and go to this suite in this building. So I'm like, all right. So I go there and Joe Pistone's behind the desk and he looks like a mob guy. He doesn't even turn around. He's like, hey, where are you from, kid? And I'm like, Jersey. He goes, where at? I'm like, Wayne. And he goes, the girls by the name of, I won't say the names, but, and I'm like, because it was five girls, all, you know, they were all in my high school, some above me, some below me. And I'm like, yeah, like Sue and her sisters. And he's like, yeah, how do you know him? I'm like, wow. I said, I forget which one worked at the gym I worked out at. And she was good looking. I used to ask her out every day. And if her boyfriend who was on a bunch of steroids ever found out, he would have kicked my ass. And he laughs and he goes, those are my goddaughters. I'm like, what?
Uh-oh.
Turns out he lived in Patterson, New Jersey when he was doing like 6 years. And he lived next to that family and he ended up being their godfather. And then they moved over to Wayne where I grew up and that's where I knew him. So he started asking if I knew certain guys. And I'm like, yeah, cause as a kid in Jersey, you know who the mob guys are. Like you just kind of, you know, like you grow up with it.
Yeah.
And he asked me about this one guy and he's like, I said, yeah. And he's like, how do you know him? I said, I dated his daughter. And he goes, what years? And I told him and he goes, and he said something. And I said, well, you mean the party where, you know, before he went to jail? He goes, yeah. So I think he was there as Donnie Brasco and I was there as a kid dating the guy. So he warned me a couple of things like all your stress is going to come from the Bureau, not the bad guys. Bad guys, everything they do, two things that every mob guy, when they make a decision, they look at greed and respect. How much money can I make and how's it going to look to everyone else? So you can predict what they're going to do. He said, all your stress is going to come from the Bureau because you can't predict what they're going to do. They're going to be jealous of you. They're going to not like you. They're going to do whatever. They're going to want to do something dumb in the case that doesn't make sense and you don't know why. And sure enough, he was 100% right. Apps like to a T, obviously, because he'd done it so long. But he said, look, you're going to do well against the bad guys because you know them. You know what to be like. You got to be careful of the Bureau. They're going to come after you. And sure enough, they did. At the end of the case, they tried to, one supervisor tried to accuse me of taking money. It was like for all the work you did, you just get screwed over in the end because they see a guy who's in the Bureau 1 year and I'm driving Corvettes. I'm driving cars. I'm living on a yacht. I got nice clothes, a nice watch. It's funny. They have a whole unit at headquarters that will send you jewelry and other props for these cases, you know? So wow. I don't wear jewelry, you know? I like a watch though. So, and at the time, you know, late 90s, you know, the watch to have, and my background was a Marine recon because I knew the world and I knew I could hide myself well. I said my father was in Marines and, you know, he got killed. type of thing. So it'd be hard for them. The mobs has contacts everywhere, but to get someone inside the bureau and stuff like that. And I said, I did that and I didn't have parents, so they didn't have any chances. But back then, like recon Marines, Navy SEALs, like the watch to have was a Rolex Submariner, because you could buy it for about $1,000 in Dubai if you went through the Middle East tour. So I write up to headquarters on electronic communications that I want just the stainless steel Submariner. And all of a sudden, like 2 weeks later, I get this, the FedEx, and I open it up, and it's got like the Mr. Guido starter kit. It's like got a pinky ring that, like, it's got a gold chain that would sink a seal. It's got this gold, gaudy gold Rolex with diamonds. And I'm like, what the F? Like, are you kidding me? So I call, and there's a phone number on it. So I call up there and I'm like, hey, explain the case. And she goes, oh, I didn't even read what I just sent you, the basic Italian kit. I'm like, okay, I'm going to send it all back and just send me a Submariner, because I can't even wear this stuff. You know?
Nothing like stereotype an entire culture.
Yeah. I'm like, did you send me some lions for my front yard too? Like, you know, cement lions.
Think about the last time you had to cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Law 21 plus terms and conditions apply. QTS is building more than a data center in Dane County. We're partnering with Alliant Energy to enable 750 megawatts of new renewable energy sources, supporting sustainable generation while lowering costs. We use a closed-loop, water-free cooling system that conserves billions of gallons of water each year. And we're investing millions locally, from scholarships and workforce development to nonprofits and first responders. QTS, powered by people, driven by purpose. Paid for by QTS.
Oh my goodness.
It was funny. It was like, you know, and at the end of the case, they accused me of taking that jewelry that I'd sent back. It was just bad.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of jealousy in there.
It is. Yeah, it is.
And I mean, with us, it was people that hadn't done that kind of work out in the field that were the ones that were jealous and making those bad decisions.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Cause you a lot of grief.
Yeah. And even in undercover, you have people that say they did, like I learned when you got in the bureau, you would talk to folks, and like the big cases, like the pizza connection with the heroin coming, everyone happened to be the case agent on the pizza connection. As you know, there's really only like one or two case agents, but everyone, like they adopt it. And I found that that's in the undercover world. So I'm very like suspect when I like, oh yeah, I did undercover. Well, your undercover was you were getting mail from a mailbox that was connected to like a Russian espionage thing. And they just, come on, you weren't even meeting it. You were getting mail. Like, stop it. So you have to, after you've been in a while, you kind of figure out who the real guys that did it were and who weren't.
It makes for good stories in the bar. But I tell you, for our listeners here, he's talking about Joe Pistone. That's Donnie Brasco. If you've seen the movie, the real Joe Pistone is an FBI agent who was undercover for 6 years.
Yeah.
I don't know how the man survived.
It was, he really kind of broke ground with it, and they learned a lot, and they made a lot of rules because of what went wrong in that one. And it's funny because his name, Joe Pistone, was his nephew. And then his nephew became an FBI agent. So there's an FBI agent, Donnie Brasco.
I mean,
that's his nephew. So it's funny because that's Then he was in the Bureau as you know, Donnie Brasco, and it was his Pistone's nephew. But yeah, Pistone, like he came back in. He got out after that. A lot of damage to his family and everything else. He got out, and then when Louis Freeh became director, because Louis Freeh knew him in New York, brought him on and really said, hey, we need you to help with this. And like you took a psychological test before you went and did Undercover. Same psychological test I took when I went to HRT. But they figure out who you are and they tell you who you are so that you know what you give out to other people. You have to really understand that. And then every 6 months, they retest you to see if your stressors have gone up. And you know, if they do go up, there's a whole program and stuff and how would they pull you out to get you some mental help to see if you can continue on or if you can't. Because it gets bad out there. Like everyone, like you start having like, oh, this, I remember this agent didn't want to do something because he wanted to watch Monday Night Football. Like, and I, you know, I'm meeting mob hitmen at midnight with no cover. Like none. And he like, just don't, oh, it's going to be late. Don't call me. I'm going to go sleep. Call me in the morning. I'm like, well, if I'm dead, I can't call you. Like, but yeah. So,
And I might be jumping forward here a little bit, but you did some undercover work. And Joe, I love Joe. He's, we're both members of a board of directors out in San Diego for the Southern California Gang Conference. And I was just talking to him this morning, as a matter of fact, on some other stuff, but is this the time that you worked against the DeCavalcante family in Jersey? Yeah. So and for our listeners, if you don't recall that, we've had just recently we had Dutch McAlpin on here who did some UC work on that. He was a local officer in Nebraska, and his partner was Giovanni Rocco, who was a local cop in Jersey that did a lot of the UC on that. I don't know. You may have worked with him. I don't know. But what was your role in that? How did that go?
So I was the bodyguard and the protector for the main guy, and he owned the yacht. He, you know, and the cooperating witness was his money launderer type of thing. And Willie would come in from California a week or two. They'd set up a bunch of deals. I drove him everywhere, and I didn't drink at the time. So I'm on the boat, and the Boca Bob was the guy that we were dealing with was an old man, and he lived down here. But he like, so Miami was an open city. Like in New York, it's very like this family has trash. This family has concrete. This, when they get in, it's their family's thing. And you don't cross the fence type of thing, or you got to have a sit down type of thing.
Right.
But in Miami, everything's open. No one has something. So if you're going to do something, you basically came down and you checked in with Bob. You kind of gave him a hint of what it was going to be. And like, he'd be like, oh, you got to go talk to so-and-so. He was kind of like, he deconflicted mob events down here. Like, oh, you're going to do that. You need to talk to this guy because they're involved in it.
Wow.
So, but he would come over and he had a Bonanno hitman that would come down and help him out a lot, Anthony. And they called him Eyeball because he'd taken a guy's eye out with a fork. And he was mean looking. Like I end up getting to be friends with them, and we go to strip clubs and strippers didn't want to dance for him. He looked so mean, literally. Like they're like, I'm not going to dance for your friend. Like he scares me. And this is like Brooklyn Queen strippers.
Wow. You know. Tough girls. So,
he had like black eyes and he wasn't in great shape. He had the typical Italian, but he went to the like Olympic trials in Greco-Roman wrestling, and he could pick up a refrigerator with two hands just by on the side.
Oh,
like he made me nervous. Like he, like that was game on. Like you got to have your shit together. And they would come over to the boat, and Peter and Willie would be there, and it would be, I would be in there doing stuff, and I would like as soon as they started like talking any type of criminal stuff, I would leave because like the boat was wired. Like there's video cameras and microphones. And like, even if Willie, the main guy, main undercover wasn't there, everything's getting recorded. I don't have to be there to witness it. So I also thought them understanding like their mentality, they don't think a mob guy, I mean, an FBI guy would be subservient and leave when they're starting to talk criminal. So every time that happened, I'm like, hey, I'll be outside. If you need something, let me know. You know, and I'd make them like, I bought a $5,000 like espresso machine for the yacht, and I'd make, you know, good coffees and stuff like that. And I would leave. And then at one day, Bob just said, hey, don't worry about it. And he let me stay. And I'd listen to the tape. Every time we had a meeting, I'd listen to the tapes. And he made a comment at one point to one of the guys, said, I like that kid. He knows when to leave.
Good.
And that to them was one of those things. And when they don't know you, they would think like, hey, if you're a cop or you're looking, you want to be there for all those. And every time I'd leave, like, hey, I'm outside. So I knew at that point, and then they end up getting to like me. One, my fake name was Rob Russo. Grew up in Jersey, Italian, and then, you know, my dad and Marines, I moved around a lot, but they liked me as Italian. They liked the fact that I was a Marine and I called people sir. They liked that. So he took a liking to me. He used to, like, he had had me over for breakfast and tell me, because he thought we were laundering money dealing heroin, and he was doing that with our guys, and he would tell me to get out of it. He goes, you don't want that. You'll do 30 years. Stick to the regular stuff, meaning like loan sharking, beating people up. Like, because a lot of them on the drug side, they knew it. That's kind of what brought some of the mob families down, because when you're facing 30 years and never getting out of prisons, people started cooperating.
Right.
If you rob like tractor trailers, you're going to get maybe 5 years, you'll do three and you'll be out, type of thing. So drugs really brought a lot of the mob guys down, because people weren't willing to do 30 years with not ratting. And so, jeez. But he would like literally like tell me to get out of that. He tried to fix me up with his granddaughter. Like, it was like crazy stuff. You know,
that'd be a little bit awkward, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah. And Pistone told me, so whatever you do, don't sleep with anyone involved in a case. Like, you got to do what you got to do, but no wives, no girlfriends, no, like, you know, whatever. You can't bring that in, because it's going to come out in court. Like, you got to, like, no matter what your situation is, it's not going to look good. So that was always in the back of my head too.
And also for our listeners, if you're not aware, this Jersey mob group is what the show The Sopranos was based on. So
that's where I grew up too. Like, when in Sopranos, when he goes to Fountains of Wayne was in my town and all that stuff there. So it is funny. The one thing that Chase really got right with the mob, with Sopranos in general, is the duality of their lives, that they have the same problems you do. Their kid's not doing well in high school and this is going on. And, you know, and then when they walk out the door, though, they flip a switch.
Yep.
They don't, like, just because their kids are in middle school, they don't care if the dope they're dealing is getting dealt in the middle school. They just don't want their kid to do it. And the girls are trafficking are the same age as their daughters. Wow. And it's a duality of that they literally can flip the switch. Now, on our side, like, talk about, like, I was in Iraq and Afghanistan quite a bit with SEALs and you know, the tier one special mission units grabbing like terrorists and going out and, you know, getting in huge firefights with them. And I would be doing, and same thing with the SEALs and the Army guys, you'd be talking to your family on the sat phone. You're doing homework with the kids, and then you put your kid on, you go out and you do some carnage that's really unspeakable at times, leaving 30 people dead on a target. And then you come back and you're back on the phone with the kids. So it's the same thing. And mob guys and cops and special ops guys are kind of a lot alike.
Right.
They're more alike than civilians than they are different. They're moralistic compass is a bit different, but same black humor to get through everything. Most of them are funny, engaging. Some are quiet and sociopaths, but it's on both sides.
Yeah, it is. And I've had the honor of working with the Deltas and the Dev Grews.
Yeah,
and lately, yes, I've gotten to speak at a couple fundraisers for organizations that support former first responders and military.
Yeah, so those are the two units I was attached to for in their buildings for like 6 years. So HRT as an LNO, I was overseas with them, and then I got put down as their liaison in their buildings. I have more friends probably in those two units than I do back in the Bureau, because I spent so much time there. But I'm also on a first responder and veteran called Outer Circle, which helps with PTSD and stuff. We're actually just doing a fundraiser now. I have to send it to you if you want to win a Staccato pistol, $3,000 gun, $50 raffle. That.
Send it to me.
A buddy of mine owns Staccato and was a donor of that. And then I'm also on a national prevention hotline, which I want to tie into the veteran community too. But I do MSNBC News now. I used to do all the networks before for commentary, and that's where the contractual stuff comes up. But I was doing one on a school shooting and talk about yellow flags. Like, this person had to say something was going on in their lives. Someone probably saw it and didn't know who to talk to about it. And there's no place really to do that. Like if, even if you're a person thinking of doing self-harm, you can call a suicide hotline. It's big and it gets 20 million plus calls a year. But if you call there and say you're thinking of harming someone else, they're not geared for that phone call. So a gentleman that owns a bunch of therapy centers and this young lady whose friend was killed by someone that warned people he was going to kill the next person who walked by his apartment, and it happened to be her friend, they started this whole hotline that you can call if you're thinking about doing harm or if you know someone or family member, because a lot of people like don't want to call and they think they're going to get someone arrested. It's counselors on there that know how to deal with that. So we're just starting. I think we're going to do, we've soft launched with that, but it's really kind of coming along. And I want to tie it also into the veteran community, where if a veteran calls, there's different programs that you can, you know, direct them to and stuff.
Excellent. Can you say the name of that, the organization?
Yeah, National it's a violence prevention hotline. It's at violenceprevention.org. I'll make sure I got that one right, type of thing. Yeah. So it's got a website and they're not 24/7 yet. We're trying to get more counselors, but we're trying to tie it into to do all that. Guy Paul Krause is the starter of it, and Gabby is the other person behind it. And it's really like when I heard it, I'm like, if you can stop one, and we've already stopped someone who said he was going to go kill three people. And it's amazing that there's nothing out there. Cause I'm a realist. Like I like guns. I don't think someone who has mental issues should have a gun. There's a happy medium in all of that. But if you think you're going to get guns off the street to point, like people on the news say, oh, we need to get all the guns off the street, that's not going to happen. That's not realistic. I'm about like what realistically works. If I can, you can't lock enough doors for that. Someone's not going to get a gun in the school. It's just, so if you can get to the person that's thinking of doing it, to me, that makes a lot of sense to try it. And you have to do multiple things. No one solution is going to work at all.
Right. And I'll be honest with you, I had not heard that, but our listeners, if you're watching this on YouTube, you'll see on the screen here, the contact information where you can get a hold of people if you think you have a situation like this. And don't sit back and think something's going to happen or think somebody else is going to take care of it. If you're aware of it, make the freaking phone call. You might save a life.
It really is. And they don't want to get that person in trouble. And this is a way to do that. You can talk to a counselor and really see, because there are, like, now that you start peeling it back, there are a lot of yellow flags. And as you know, 3 or 4 yellow flags equals red flag. It's one of those things. And if you're thinking about it, give them a call and talk to them and get some professional advice. Did you pull up the website? Did I have the website right?
I haven't pulled it up.
Okay. Yeah. Violence prevention hotline.org.
When this comes out, I'll have it right. I promise. Okay. So this won't come out for a couple of weeks.
It's bad. If I had looked at it right before I did this, I didn't think I'd be talking about it, but.
You never know. You never know. So in your career now, you moved from the UC work, and you were undercover for like 2 years, right?
Yeah.
And then your next step is like completely opposite of working undercover.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's that group called?
The FBI's hostage rescue team.
Yeah. I tell you what, when we went through the academy, we had the cafeteria was over top of the gun cleaning room. So you got to smell hoppies with all your food.
Yeah.
You remember those days, but you could tell when the HRT guys came in because everybody's just looking at them and they're just fit. I mean, they're no nonsense, close cropped hair in there, eat, get out, get back to work. Like, yeah, go team. Love that. What was the attraction there? And what was your first responsibilities with HRT?
When I got out of the Marines, got an FBI, and same thing, I went to, you know, the academy and saw it. You hear the helicopters, you hear all the explosions, you hear tons of gunfire, and they're like in their own compound at the end of the quarter, and everyone, like, the rumors that of what happens down there are crazier than what actually does. But I didn't think I want to do it. It was a 2-week selection. I've been through Force Recon Indoc, been through all the schools, did that. And I just wasn't sure if I wanted to do it again. But anytime, like, again, everything's a competition to me. And that I got on the FBI SWAT team in Miami. Even when I was doing undercover, I'd wear balaclava. Even when I trained with local police, because we had some things that I ran into local cops when I was undercover. But it's the pinnacle of, if you like SWAT, that's SWAT plus times 10. It's full time. it's all you do. You go to every school, you work with Dev Group and Delta and you know, all those guys. You're going to schools. We started free falling. We did closed circuit scuba. We had boats and helicopters. And so I was just like, at that point I did the undercover and I just want something that I wanted to do. So timing wise, cause it's a young man's sport.
You know,
selection is brutal. It's 2 weeks. Harder, like, and I've been to amphib recon school, jump school, boot camp, officer candidate school, like none of it really compared to that. It was just a different selection. We weren't, all the physical stuff is meant to break you down, and it's meant to break you down so that you can't, cause if you go up there, you know what they're looking for. You know what the answer should be. You know how you should act, type of thing. And the problem is if people have like all their, you know, energy, they can fake it. But when you are so smoked physically, you get smoked mentally, you can't fake really who you are. And that's why they break you down to because what really counts is and we don't want a guy who runs 5 minute miles who can't put a pack on and you know, 80 pounds for 20 miles. So it's a mixture, but you want someone who can make the decision after hiking 20 miles of the ruck, having run 5 miles before that, not knowing how far you're going. You want them to be able to make good, sound, tactical judgments when you're doing things. So in order to break people down, we have to just smoke them physically to get the raw them out. And you're surprised. And another thing is like, people that get to that point, they get to the FBI, they get to HRT. Some of them are freaks physically. They've never failed at anything in their lives, ever. They've gone to some Ivy League schools. They've done well. They've gotten in the Bureau. When you get in the Bureau, they tell you how special you are. You're not. but they build you up like that, and you get to selection, and they maybe never have failed anything in their life. And HRT selection, we will make you fail things. Like even if – if you run 5 minute miles and you start and you never know how every event you start, you don't even know what it's going to be. You don't know if you're running 5 miles, 10 miles or 2 miles. You have no idea. But when you start it, you just got to give your all, your effort. We will put, like, if the guy runs so fast, we'll put an operator every mile to make sure that he's still running fast, like someone staying with him. And an operator will be with you. I remember I was doing it ended up being like a 5 or 7 mile run, and I'm running. And the entire time there's this operator running next to me, not saying one word, didn't say a word to me the entire time. He's just watching me to see what my effort is, to see what I'm doing. And so when we make the ones that have never failed fail, some of them literally go DOR right then. They don't know how to deal with it. And that's not the guy you want. You want a guy that fails, gets up, dusts himself off, and then keeps going. And that's the one thing, like, we got a lot of our selection from Delta and stuff. And talking to guys down there, the long walk is one of these really crazy, hard things to do. And you know, the people that – there's one guy who was telling me that, like, we had this guy, DOR. He dropped on request. And it turns out he convinced himself he had no chance. He was the number one guy when he did that. He was their number one guy. But they don't want them if you're going to quit. One of those things. So again, we share all that stuff back and forth. We have psychologists there. We have, it's not as arbitrary as you think. It's a hard selection, but there's a method to madness. And every obstacle you do, every long, crazy thing is based on a real life event that HRT went through. So when we go back, cause we've gotten sued, we've gotten accused of everything. And we have to, it stands up in court saying, well, that op that he's saying wasn't fair was exactly what happened at this year at this time. And these operators had to do this. Like we had to arrest Alberto, this guy that was wanted for 20 years in Puerto Rico. He had killed an agent, I think shot an agent that lost her eye. He was one of these government people in the like 70s. And then he fled to Puerto Rico and was hidden. And we had to go figure out if it was him. And I remember I was on the sniper team that went in, and it was just 1,000 meters we were moving, and it took us 9 hours. I was climbing a waterfall with an 80-pound pack. And it was one of those brutal things that, again, we ended up putting that into a selection because it was something that the team did that we could say, look, this is not fake. We're testing for real life situations. But it was great because there's only, I think, since the team formed in 1983, I think there's only about 400 total FBI HRT operators since that time. So the number's small.
Wow. I mean, it is the cream of the crop. That was when we had the Delta guys and SEAL Team 6 with us in Colombia, and we were in Medellin for 18 months. That was when you probably ran into Jerry Boykin.
I know him.
So he was Colonel Boykin. He got his first star while he was in Colombia. But seeing their capabilities, living with them, getting to know them, staying in contact afterwards, still in touch today with a couple of them, we make no bones about it. To this day, we say if we're ever kidnapped, that's who we want to come and get us, because we've seen what their capabilities are. I would absolutely trust them with my life. No question about it.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things. I've been involved in several hostage rescues between those guys and the SEALs. I was there when they got Jessica Buchanan out of the desert in Somalia. I actually helped find her to begin with a couple months earlier and stuff. But those guys, I know the team leader, they jumped out of a plane at, I think, is about 25,000 feet in the middle of the night. And I think you can't jump. You do a free fall jump at over like 20 knot winds. That's one of the, and from what I heard, maybe from some guys that were up there, they were clocking like 30 plus knot winds. So they should have not jumped. And I think they threatened the air crew saying that winds are not above 15 knots. You will not report, like basically you will not report that we're going out the plane. And they did. And they jumped out and they walked 3 or 4 miles silently and killed all 9 pirates that were sleeping around Jessica and her mate that was also kidnapped with them. And I actually talked to her on a webinar about it and stuff. But that's the mission they live for, like to free fall in a hostage rescue. Same thing. It's like one of those things. And I remember meeting one of the Medal of Honor winners out of Delta, one of the living ones. And they will never tell you what they got medal wise. It's someone else saying, hey, you know that guy. And then you hear the story and you're like, are you kidding me? And people sometimes I like to say I'm like Forrest Gump in my career. I just fell into really fun things. And a couple of people have said, like, you're telling stories, and I don't want to tell stories of brag. You know, it's because I know a lot of people have done a lot more type of thing. And when I'm with those guys, like I'll meet up with the Delta dudes and we're all just talking stories about what we've done. And it's not trying to one up each other. It's just entertaining each other and stuff like that.
Right.
But someone said, well, how do you not be like so arrogant or whatever? I'm like, dude, I've been around guys who've won the Medal of Honor.
Right.
Like I know one sniper who killed 21 dudes in a morning and you think I'm going to get like, you got to be confident. But if you're arrogant amongst that, like that's not going to work. I mean, you're around the best of the best and you better be humble because someone's always better. One thing. And like it's amazing when you meet them. Again, quietest guy in the room's probably killed the most people. Like it's one of those things that happens. Like they're like, oh yeah, that guy. And that's how I found out about the sniper. Him waxing 21 dudes in a morning.
Unbelievable, like, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, I think you feel the same way. It's an honor to be associated with those kind of people in my world. There's an old saying says, if you got to toot your own horn, it's probably not worth tooting.
Yeah. Yep.
I try to live by that because it's like you say, you may have done something great, but there's somebody that did something greater.
Yeah. And I always say sharing their stories amongst those folks. And it's funny because I think I earned some respect from those guys because when every time you get with a new unit, they're like, oh, who's this guy? Because I'd be embedded with different SEAL teams, with different ODAs and stuff. And then it's a dog sniffing thing type of thing, unless you worked with them before. But just sharing stories, I would tell them about the mob undercover. And to them, like that was pretty cool to them because they'd seen it in the movies and stuff. And I'm thinking it wasn't that big of a deal. But it did bring you up on that scale with them and stuff like that. So it's one of those things. And again, some of their stories are just funny and getting around and having a beer with them. It's just good times. And every time I see them, anytime you do, even if it's a short deployment, say 60 days in combat or 90 days in combat with them and you're going on target with them, that's like a lifetime. Like you never... like those people are friends. I could call them up right now and say, hey, look, I need to come down... You can't ask what you're going to do. Don't bring a cell phone and they'll be at my front door.
Yep. Love him. Love him. Did you ever do any work with Tony Thomas? So you must have. Here comes a good story.
So I was the JSOC LNO. So I was the senior FBI advisor to the three-star position there. General Votel left and Tony Thomas came in. And I heard Tony Thomas, you hear about him before he comes in. He's got, I don't want to say a reputation, but he's a big personality. And so you hear about him. And the biggest thing I heard, Philly. Like, he's from Philly. He's an Eagles fan. I'm a Giants fan. I'm from Jersey. So we're at the table of all the primaries, all the J1, the J2, the J3. So all the colonels are there in the FBI and CIA, LNO, me and are sitting there. And he's going around the table kind of asking for stuff. And he's like, hey, anything from FBI? I'm like, and it was just happened to be a chance, something I said, yeah, the Eagles are going to lose the Giants or something like that. That's all I got to say. And and everyone's like, it's his first day. Everyone's like, kind of, I don't want to say kissing his ass, but you know.
Yeah, well, they are. They are.
Yeah, we're going to get along. And then he just goes on. And it was one of those things. And I always told him, like, there's one stadium I will not wear a Giants shirt to, and that's
the Philly Stadium.
The Philly Stadium. Yeah. Yeah, there's a jail in the stadium for a reason.
I love it.
He was great. And it's funny because I really had a chance. I've worked with Admiral McCraven, with Votel, Tony Thomas, General Miller. I've worked with the absolute best that the military has to offer. And every one of them is quite different. But all those top ones, all those ones that were JSOC commanders, and a buddy of mine who I actually hunted Saddam Hussein with, John, is the commander there now. And every one of them has such an unbelievable ability to get data in mass amounts and then find these little connections out of it. They would flip you out at sometimes. That I remember, was it McCraven or McChrystal? I think it was McCraven. He was getting this, the height of the GWAT war. You're doing raids all the time and you're in the jock getting unbelievable intel briefs. Like some days you do the battlefield update and you're doing, talking about ops. And then there'd be deep dives into different terrorist cells and stuff. And I remember one point, some intel analyst is going through something they worked on a month for, you know, talking about connections between Jordan and this group and stuff like that. And I'm just dozing. I'm like, God, these names are all the same. I don't, you know. I'm like,
ugh.
Yep. And all of a sudden, like, McCraven stops him and he goes, wait a second. Didn't that guy call that guy about a month ago? And the analyst stops and is like going through the thing. And he's like, I think check the report. And sure enough, someone else comes up on the, you know, on one of the cameras and said, yes, sir. And I'm like, how in the middle of all this that you're getting, like these names are all sound the same, that you remembered a brief about a month ago that guy talked to that guy with everything, like the ability to go through that. And McCraven was another, he's like General Thomas, personality wise. I saw him when he was a Navy captain at the Pentagon. I was doing reserve duty at the Pentagon, even when I wasn't supposed to being in the Bureau. And I met him on a hostage situation in the Philippines. We did some talk and he came down to HRT. At that point, he made his star and left. And like 9 years later, I'm in Iraq and I'm helping JSOC do their biometric system. So I'm out there with a couple operators and some tech guys. And the Bureau had a fingerprint system that they were trying to get a hold of. And I'm in a courtyard on Balad. And he walks in to his courtyard and he looks at me. He goes, hey, Rob, how you doing? And I'm thinking, like, I know you. You're the three-star. Like, you met me, like, 9 years ago, like, two meetings. You walk into a courtyard where you're not expecting me. And you just look at me and say, hey, Rob, I can't remember all four of my kids' names. And you remember that, like, but that was again, all those guys' ability. And I remember just sitting in briefs with General Thomas and him mentoring on decision-making and how he would explain why he was making a decision, not because he had to, because all the people around him, it made better, like what he was thinking type of thing. And he was one of those guys that really got that way, and had us over his house for get-togethers and stuff like that. He was a great guy. I've talked to him a couple times since he's got out, but I'm friends with him on Facebook, and he's like so enjoying his grandkids.
Good for him. Knows,
yeah.
Yeah. Give him my regards, if you would. He was with us in Medellin for 18 months there. And well, I think he was there probably for 3 or 4 months, but he was a captain back then. And then later in life, in my second headquarters tour, an SES now, and I go to this joint federal law enforcement military thing, and we're sitting, there's only like 15 people in there, and we're sitting in a big U, and they came in and they said, well, our first speaker's on his way. They were fogged in at Fort Bragg, but he's on his way. So we'd be just a little bit late. And so we're doing other things. And he comes walking in, and I didn't know who was coming, and I didn't recognize him because it'd been so long. And he gets to talking, and I'm listening, and I'm liking what I'm hearing. And he says, and he's talking about cooperation amongst military and law enforcement. And he said, I'll give you a perfect example. Take Murph over there. When we were in Medellin, I'm like, who in the heck is this guy? And then it finally hit me, Tony Thomas. I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know he'd made a general. Yeah. But impressive guy. Very impressive man.
It's funny because Admiral McCraven was giving a speech. Someone, it's on YouTube, his famous speech about making your bed mm-hmm. in the morning.
Yeah.
But he was giving a speech somewhere. I don't know. It was some FBI law enforcement again thing. And all of a sudden I start getting these texts that, like, McCraven just mentioned you in a same thing. He was talking about law enforcement and stuff like that and pulled up an example of what we did or something.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow. Like, I didn't even know.
Yeah, that's impressive. That's impressive. Rob, we've been going well over an hour here. So everybody, we're going to stop for today, but Rob's going to join us again tomorrow for part two. So appreciate you guys coming in. Please come back tomorrow because we're going to talk about the first question I want to ask him is, what's the main operation that he's most proud of? And I'm not sure what he's going to say. I got an idea, but join us tomorrow and you'll find out too. So in the meantime, thank you for joining us here on Game of Crimes. God bless. We'll see you tomorrow.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
QTS is building more than a data center in Dane County. We're partnering with Alliant Energy to enable 750 megawatts of new renewable energy sources, supporting sustainable generation while lowering costs. We use a closed-loop, water-free cooling system that conserves billions of gallons of water each year. And we're investing millions locally, from scholarships and workforce development to nonprofits and first responders. QTS, powered by people, driven by purpose. Paid for by QTS.
Did you know that over 80% of companies in America, each generating more than $100 million in revenue, don't show up on public stock exchanges? They're private and are largely not an option for 401k investors. But now there's a chance for everyday American savers to opt in for access through the 401k plan if they choose to. Regardless of how you're building for the future, you deserve the same opportunities because you've earned the right to more. Learn more by visiting retiresafer.org. Paid for by the Council for a Safe and Secure Retirement.